The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Malika Fitzhugh, who goes by Mel, is a contemporary composer with a flair for historical instruments. The Harvard Radcliffe and Bard-trained musician enjoys playing and composing for historical instruments, including Renaissance and Baroque recorders, viols, harpsichord, and organ. She also plays a mind-boggling list of instruments: violin, viola, cello, double bass, acoustic guitar and bass, recorders, flute, clarinet, saxophone, trumpet, and a variety of hand percussion instruments. As an instrumentalist, Malika Fitzhugh's performances span many genres, including membership in Quilisma Consort, which plays music from the 14th through 16th centuries. Mel Fitzhugh joins me via Zoom to chat about her remarkable career. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, pandemic is tough on everyone, and there are many special challenges for musicians. So how are you doing?
Actually, I'm doing well. My friend from college has let me use her basement guest room to do Wi-Fi and teach and such. So we had the, because both of us live alone, we had the ability to be together during this entire year. And she has a dog, so have to shout out Cassie, the 12-year-old golden retriever.
Aww.
Who's lovely.
Nice.
And so it's actually been pretty good. I miss rehearsing with people, but I have Zoom calls and Google Meet calls with most of my ensembles on a weekly basis just to check in, see how we're doing and such. And I've been doing a lot of composing during this time, so there is that as well.
Yeah, interesting. I know that a number of musicians I've spoken with have kind of said the same thing, like some of the things that they have maybe put off or didn't necessarily have as much consolidated time to devote to things like composing or maybe writing papers and books that they've wanted to write. You know, they've really used that time to, you know, to redirect their creativity. So that's great.
Yes, absolutely.
Great.
That's been, I guess, a silver lining.
Yeah. So you're such a versatile musician. And I want to go back to the beginning and find out, what was your initial introduction into music? You know, what was your first instrument and how old were you?
Well, I was 5, begging my grandmother and my mother to get me a guitar because I wanted to be just like Elvis Presley and Chuck Berry.
Oh.
And I finally got a guitar for my 6th birthday.
Wow.
And they took me to Fredericksburg, Virginia to, I think it was Robertson's Music. And I studied classical guitar for 3 years
with
Hans Brennan. It was great. I learned Schumann and Bartok. And of course, all of the great finger picking styles of the 70s, the late 70s.
Wow. So I was going to say, yeah, so you asked for a guitar to be like Elvis and Chuck Berry and you end up playing Schumann and Bartok.
It was a great thing. To this day, I still love Bartok and Schumann.
Wow. And, how does a 6-year-old get her arms and hands around guitar?
I have always been tall. I've been this height, 5'10", 3/4", since I was 10.
Wow.
So I know that when I was 8, I was my grandmother's height at 5'4". So when I was 6, I was probably over close to 5 feet tall.
Wow.
So the first guitar I had was a 3/4" size guitar.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I was 7, I still have that full-size guitar. That's a Yamaha. It's all red flamey and such. But I still have that guitar from when I was 7, the full-size guitar.
Wow.
So, because I've always been tall and long-armed.
Yeah. Wow. So then how did you add on all these other instruments? How did that happen?
Well, in third grade, so kindergarten is when I started guitar. Third grade, I got to participate in special music. And in Stafford, Virginia, which is where I grew up, not everybody had the opportunity to learn recorder. I guess everybody in all the schools nowadays in third or fourth grade learn recorder. But special music program, we got to play for the PTA, I remember. I think it was something like he's got the whole world in his hands or something, or hot cross buns. But we played, so I learned the recorder in third grade. Fifth grade, had the opportunity to join the orchestra. So I learned viola because I did not like the high E string of the violin. Everybody else was flocking to the violin. I'm like, no! But so I chose the viola because it was still a shoulder-held instrument. So it was still portable, but did not have that E string shrieking in the hands of the uninitiated.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I played that throughout middle school, got to high school, joined the band, playing percussion. Because it turns out in public school, they didn't teach percussionists how to hear notes. So the band director was desperate for somebody who could play timpani, could tune the drums, who could tell the difference between a C and a D, which the percussionists that were coming into the school, they were completely tone deaf. Amazing, talented percussionists, you know, but apparently just couldn't differentiate pitch because they had never been taught to differentiate pitch.
Wow.
So that's when I started in the band. And then I had lots of friends who were willing to teach me their instruments. So I learned clarinet and saxophone once I joined the band. And of course I'd played different of the string instruments, you know, throughout the entire time.
Yeah.
But I always gravitated to the viola because it just had that beautiful warm tone and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were fewer people playing it, so in competitions I always got to be first or second chair.
Oh, good in strategy. Yeah. Good business sense. So when did you start composing? You know, was that
in high school?
Yeah, in high school. And what were some of your first compositions like?
Very rudimentary, but a lot of fun. One of the first things I ever did was an arrangement of the Young and Restless theme from my middle school string orchestra.
Oh, wow.
That was a lot of fun. Mrs. Ross let me pass out parts, and we all played it, and it was very exciting.
Wow. Were you a Young and Restless fan, watcher?
Well, my grandmother was very into her stories. You know, being a Southern wife, she called them her stories, and farm work would happen as I grew up on a farm. Farm work would happen in the morning, and then her stories would happen in the afternoon during the summer. So Young and the Restless, All My Children, General Hospital, there were no cartoons for me. There was the soap operas. So that theme was one of the things that stuck in my brain. And
formative melody.
Yeah.
So were your mom or grandmother, were either of them musicians as well?
Well, my grandmother, she was a Southern Baptist deaconess, so she sang. Mm-hmm. I think that before she became a deaconess, probably she'd been in the choir. But my mother was a concert pianist and also played piano for a church choir. So, and my Uncle Verdi, I swear when I was younger, I swear he played banjo and harmonica. And he might have been the one to blame for me being obsessed with Chuck Berry and Elvis Presley. Yeah. Because my mother was more into, like, my grandmother and my mother, they mostly listened to, like, Mahalia Jackson, you know, some of the gospel stars and
such.
And my mother had this piano bench full of, like, Rachmaninoff and the Bartok Meeker Cosmos, which is how I taught myself piano when I was in high school and such.
Wow. So do you have perfect pitch?
I do not. Not even slightly. No.
Oh, okay. So, yeah.
I mean, relative pitch, but not perfect pitch, which I think is an advantage because I can play in any temperament, any tuning, like 415, 440, 465, doesn't matter. As long as I know what the A is, I can figure out how things are supposed to sound in relation.
Yeah. So now, why don't you explain what that means? Because not everyone necessarily knows that. And, you know, that's also a skill that not a lot of musicians necessarily have to find simply because they don't necessarily bounce back and forth between modern and historical instruments as you do. So, you know, there are different temperaments and different, you know, pitches that are used based on whether you're playing in historical, you know, an historical instrument or a modern instrument. So you want to give the thumbnail sketch?
Most instruments today are equal temperament, meaning the distance between each half step is the same. So that means that a piano can play in any key and any time. You can modulate from C sharp minor to D major without any kerfluffles, or D flat major to C major without any troubles. in historically, when pitch was more centered around the relationship between notes, so the ratios, you know, that, what was it, 3 to 2 is a fifth, I think, mm-hmm. you know, the distance between half steps was a little bit wonkier. Mm-hmm. And so pure fifths and pure thirds sound differently in different temperaments, the just intonation or well-tempered or what is the one? Mean tone. Yeah. Mean tone is the one that my ensemble, the Quillisma Consort, our recorders are mean tone. So you can get these pure, ringier fifths and such than you can in, because the fifth is slightly squashed in equal temperament because the half steps are the same. Mm-hmm. So it's just a different way of listening, a different way of hearing the relationship between notes, really. Mm-hmm. And in Baroque period, I'm told, I wasn't there, so I don't know for sure, but I'm told that A, it was closer to 415, meaning 415 hertz, as opposed to today, it's been settled into a brighter, more energized 440. So it's because an open A string, when it's tuned to 440, actually vibrates faster than an open A string tuned to 415. I think that 415 sounds chocolatier. Like, it just has this chocolatey sound to it. Hmm. So I love playing in 415.
I love that expression, chocolatey. And it kind of explains my a little bit of the answer to my next question, which is one of the things that I find so exciting and so fascinating about your compositions is your use of these historical instruments in a contemporary musical language. So what inspired you to do that?
Well, I loving playing historical instruments that were, you know, I've never actually played an instrument from 1570, but I've played reproductions, right. And it's just so exciting. The tone of it, the timbre, it's different to play an instrument that's based, like a vihuela is, it looks like a guitar. It, you know, from the uninitiated, you look at it, it's like, oh, a string instrument that's shaped like this. Ah, it's a guitar, and you play it by plucking. Oh, it's a, but the timbre of it is so different, probably because it has gut strings or the inner construction that I know nothing about since I'm not a woodworker, but it just, it settles on the ear differently. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say one is more pleasant than the other, but it's different and it's exciting to me. Yeah. And also, like I said, I had an experience a couple of years ago. Well, at this point, I think it was like 2014, so many years ago, where a local recorder player, Aldo Abreu, and Barrett Strong, a local guitar player, had agreed to play a piece that I'd written. And, you know, we had met at his house, and they played through the entire thing, and it was great and fantastic. And he's like, oh, well, have you thought about doing it in Baroque pitch? And so he got out his 415 soprano recorder, and she tuned down to 415, and they played it, and it was like, oh! Same notes, same players, same tempi. Wow. He had a different instrument, but, you know, same professional quality instrument. But it just sounded so warmer and so more chocolatey. That's the only way I can describe it. And so that's when I really started writing specifically for historical instruments. You know, it's if I have a chance to get a cellist to play a piece or I have a chance to have a viola da gambas play a piece, a bass viola da gamba, I'm going to go for the viola da gamba because that, the timbre of it. I mean, 440 is bright and wonderful and exciting, and that's why orchestras, I think in the late 1800s, early 1900s, somewhere in the annals of time, they decided in Europe and in the US to settle on that being tuning pitch because it's bright, it fills halls, it's very exciting. But I like that more intimate, little bit darker chocolatey sound of the 415. Yeah. It's great for chamber music, for playing things that are intimate and in a smaller space instead of a big concert hall. So
sure. And I think, you know, I think now even a lot of major orchestras are even bumping up the pitch.
Yeah, like 443,
442,
some of them.
443, yeah.
I think the BSO was 441 or 442.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah.
But
And it's so interesting, you know, you raise a really good point, too, about chamber music. I mean, these instruments are more intimate. They don't project in the same way that modern instruments do, not only right. because of the pitch and tuning, but simply because of the construction and whatnot. Correct. And they do have a more intimate sound to them and are much more suited to chamber music and that sort of blend between the instruments.
Yes, blend.
Yeah.
It's very, very wonderful to have instruments that are just soaking each other's sound mm-hmm. together. And
do you find, like, you know, so for example, there would have been, you know, like broken consorts or whatever. Do you find that you approach combining instruments in a similar way that they might have in those days? Or are you just sort of, you're just interested in the timbres of the musicians and you sort of combine
mostly them? Just interested in the timbres and mm-hmm. combining. I mean, sometimes I will just do for a single consort. Like I've done pieces for the Boston Recorder Orchestra, which is all matched Lavergne recorder, Renaissance style recorder instruments. And that's great fun having that enormous breadth of sound when you have the contrabass of all the way up to the sopranino.
Right.
Recorders and everyone breathing together and glorious, fantastic. Yeah. But I also like combining harpsichord and, you know, viola da gamba and recorder, or continuo organ and kirtle and sopranino recorder. Why not?
Just
because the timbre, the way they blend together and such, and the different colors you can have.
Yeah. And it's been interesting to see, too, I think, as some of these older instruments, these historical instruments, have become more taught and become more common than they were anyway over the years. I mean, I've been doing Sunday Baroque for a few decades now. And, mm-hmm. you know, I've seen sort of the quality of performance has really improved and increased. Mm-hmm. And so the ability to play virtuosic licks on instruments that used to be a little bit more difficult, you know what I mean? The yes. level of musicianship has really improved greatly. So
indeed,
it
yes.
sort of pushes the limits of what you can write as a composer. Mm-hmm. So getting into composing, you know, composers, of course, write, you know, you write on your own as well, but sometimes you get commissions, and I know you've received commissions. So how do you start to compose something? I mean, you sit down with this blank page and, you know, like if you get a commission, for example, how much input do you get about what the final product should be? And you know, like, where do you start? Literally, what is the first thing you put down on that piece of paper or
computer
screen?
Well, it depends on who's commissioning, because sometimes if it's a vocalist and they have, you know, they have a vocal range. So that's going to be a constraint that mm-hmm. I welcome constraints, really. And if they've chosen a text, like a few years ago, I had for my recorder ensemble, we had a guest tenor singer mm-hmm. in with us, and he wanted to do a piece based on these Aztec poems of lamentation, and translated into English, but still there were Nahuatl city names.
Wow.
Really? Alicia, you want to sing Nahuatl? All right, we're just going to go with that. So I started exploring, you know, the sound of the human voice with tenor recorders, tenors, and had dissonances and unisons, and just exploring these things. A fair amount of dissonance, because these were poems of lamentation of destruction of cities by the Spaniards and mm-hmm. and such. But other times, like, I've been participating in Patricia Abreu's New Music for New Musicians series. So I'll get with her students and ask them, well, what do you like to play? What kinds of things do you like to play on the piano? What feels easy? What do your fingers like to do? And I'll start with some things that imitate the pieces that they like to play. So that they're having fun, but they're doing something new. And I'll do something different with it. Like, one student really liked ragtime. So I did a piece that was vaguely raggish, you know, had that sort of striding bass, but in 7/8. Instead of in 2/4. So
a little twist, a little drama.
A little bit. Yeah, it was very exciting. So it really depends. This past year, I had been writing pieces for solo instruments that were twists on Gabriel Garcia Marquez's novel titles. Like, I did Love in the Time of COVID-19, The Winter of Recrudescence, what was the other? Oh, 100 Days of Solitude. Yeah. And I had a third. Oh, Chronicle of a Pandemic Foretold. So
that's great. That's great.
I had all these different things that.
So is the process sort of similar to someone who's a writer where you just like, you know, are you disciplined in that way where you just sort of sit down every day or week or whatever and just say, I'm going to devote X number of hours to composing music and I'll see what comes out?
Rarely. Sorry.
Okay. Okay.
Most of the time, things come to me in dream. Oh. And sometimes in the middle of the night, I'll sit up and I'll either type into my BlackBerry. Yes, I still have a BlackBerry.
Wow.
I love a keyboard that I could feel. I'll sort of, because I use LilyPond for making scores or making PDFs.
Okay.
So I can just type LilyPond code in the middle of the night into my BlackBerry for the pitches and rhythms that of what I've just had in a dream. Or sometimes I'll write it in the dark. And then I have no idea what I was writing in the next morning. So yes, usually I just grab my BlackBerry because that's safer.
Wow.
And I'll write things down that I hear in my head. And
uh-huh.
And sometimes it'll make it into a piece. Sometimes it doesn't. But I have these little scraps of melody, scraps of rhythm, rhythmic material, melodic material, whatever, that I can take and put into a piece.
So teaching is a really important part of your musical life, too. You alluded a little bit to it before. What do you love about teaching and how have you adapted to that during COVID?
Well, I've been doing it all online via Zoom, whatever the student wants to use. If they want to use Zoom, Skype, Google Meet, Google Hangout, whatever, I will connect with them in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And the main thing that I like to teach or pass on to students is a joy in music, having fun with music, and also decent technique. So,
yeah.
But the most important thing is the joy of music. So if they are starting on violin and they hit a wall or something, well, I'm okay with them trying some piano or a different instrument. If they, if they've been playing piano all their life, but they want to start playing with their friends, sure. Well, we can learn some guitar too. Why not?
Yeah. So are you finding, obviously there are some downsides to having to teach, long distance online.
But Muchiness is terrible.
Yeah. I've spoken to a couple of music teachers who have said that there were these unexpected advantages. For example, one pianist said that he was now aware of the kind of instruments that his students have at home that he wouldn't necessarily have even thought to ask about before.
Right.
So there's a little bit of an advantage of now being able to see kind of what they have to contend with and what kind of an instrument, and maybe advise the family about, upgrading to another instrument. So have you found any advantages amongst the disadvantages of having to teach online?
Well, I mostly taught privately and I was going into people's homes anyway, so I mostly see what they had to contend with.
Right.
So that wasn't a distinct advantage. But what I do enjoy is not having to cut off people. I am terrible with time. I admit it freely. So some of my half-hour lessons end up being 45 minutes. But it gives us the chance to just explore a topic and not have to worry about, oh, I have somebody coming in, so if somebody arrived 5 minutes late, I would have to cut them off at, 2 to the hour to allow them to, pack up their stuff and leave. Or I had to go because I had to get in my car and drive to another house.
Right.
So just having the leisureliness of being able to explore whatever topic, and, my students feel like they can contact me outside of lessons if they have questions or if they're hitting a wall in their practice.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a quick, let's just connect. I have 5 minutes. Let's look at what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Give some advice and go. So
that's
been nice.
Yeah. And I love the idea too that, through this time, music is so important and it's something that does bring us together. And so to be able to continue that and to be able to continue to connect with your students, I think is really more important
than
ever.
Very important. Yeah. Yes.
And for you to connect with them as well. So now you were a composer in residence for the March 2021 Virtual Women Composers Festival of Hartford. Would you talk about that a little bit? I was not even familiar with this festival, and I would love to know about, you know, what your experience was like and what was some of the music celebrated there.
Well, so it was different this year because it was the first virtual. I was supposed to be 2020. 2020 ceased to exist.
Yeah.
So I don't know if my experience is anything like experience of composers in residence for that festival before, because I was supposed to have gone into schools and talked about composition and and playing music, but that none of that got to happen at all. So it was mostly just, you know, I got finally had my string quartet that I wrote in 2019 performed. That was very exciting for me. I have 7 string quartets, only at this point 2 of them have been performed.
Wow.
So trying to get those done. But it was great because Patricia Abreu, who I mentioned before, who has her New Music for New Musicians program, she did a video on it and had featured 3 of her students playing, you know, the pieces that I wrote for them for that series.
Cool.
Which is great and fantastic. We got to hear about different programs that people are doing during pandemic. I think it was Catherine Woodard had Sonic Crossroads, where she has done a grading system for her students because, you know, that so a lot of the end of year recitals and competitions didn't happen in 2020.
Right.
So a way to do them online virtually.
Yeah.
And such. So that was exciting. And having the, of course, the concert of women composers, historical and living, is always nice. That's my favorite part of the music marathon, is my favorite part of this festival. That usually just happens in Hartford, Connecticut. For several years, it was at the Charter Oak Center for the Arts. And last couple of years, it was at Trinity College. 2020 was supposed to be at the Hart School, which is where it was founded. But, you know.
Yeah. So, yeah, you raise another really good point, and that is that it's kind of hard, unfortunately, to find recordings of music by women composers from the Baroque era or before, you know. And so
except Hildegard von Bingen, like, she was really popular for a while in the 90s. There was a lot of recordings then.
Right.
And it's sort Barbara of... Barbara Strozzi is, like, becoming huge. And Elizabeth de la Jacquet?
Jacquet de la Guerre.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. But it's been, you know, like, little dribs and drabs, but, you know, little by little. But I look forward to when we can learn more about some of these women. It's not that they didn't exist. It's just that they didn't have the same kind of, you know, access to, and so many of them were nuns, too. So that music was, you know, in a cloistered archive somewhere. And so, you know, so I look forward to when we, you know, little by little kind of piece together more of that history of those women. Because I think it really creates more of a timeline to the, you know, to the now.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
It's very exciting. And then there's the people who are discovering things in their attics of, you know, women from the 1800s and, you know, that weren't permitted to get published because their husbands wouldn't allow it and whatnot. And
Right.
Getting some of that music out of dank basements. And
I know. Before it gets, you know,
completely ruined.
Completely ruined and illegible. Exactly. So what are you most passionate about at this moment? You know, what are the things that really make you excited, you know, optimistic, inspired, happy, whatever, pessimistic, upset, you know, what are the things that really just kind of grab you right now in this moment?
At this very moment, I think that just being able to write music and that people are playing, you know, for years I've been writing music that I occasionally could get friends of mine to play, which, you know, was great. Love Kulisma and Lisa and Carolyn, because they put up with playing a lot of... I don't think we could do this. I think you can. Yeah, I think you could try. It's impossible. Maybe just try. kinds of things, you know, conversations. But now there are people who are outside of my circle of friends who are playing music, which is very exciting. I had Sarah Jeffries, who's in Amsterdam, play two of my recorder pieces this past year, which is very exciting. So exciting.
Yeah.
And then I had a piece published by the American Recorder Society for their Play the Recorder Month. And so other people are playing music that I've written. And I'm just very excited about all of that.
Yeah.
March and April 2020 is like my 15 minutes of fame, I guess, for my entire life.
But well, I hope it lasts. Very exciting. I hope it lasts longer than 15 minutes. But like, so what can you share, any kind of like projects you have on the horizon?
Well, X Aequo, a guitar collective in New York, they commissioned a piece for me back in the end of 2019, which is supposed to be premiered, I think in the end of May or early June. So that's going to be exciting.
Oh, great. A
guitar solo piece. And there was talk of, you know, sort of reshaping it maybe for student guitar work. So I was tasked to make it, to write a piece for a professional, but with the idea that it might be simplified in some way to be done for students. So that's going to be exciting. I have some, in the end, I am actually going to be talking to students in schools in, I think, Arizona and in Virginia, my old stomping grounds, about composing and what it's like to be a composer in a year of not leaving your friend's basement.
I look forward to seeing, you know, what your next exciting project is. I have been speaking with Mel Fitzhugh. She is a composer, an innovator, a teacher, a multi-instrumentalist via Zoom about her remarkable life in music. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been such a pleasure.